It's good to be with you. My great dread is when I come to Greenbelt is that I'll turn up at the tent and Jim Wallace will be next door, and the big line that I see outside my tent is actually going into Jim's, and no one will be there. I can remember actually being invited to go and speak at a meeting in Sydney once, and I travelled all the way from Brisbane to Sydney in the bus, and I got to the venue and I was met by the organiser, and we sat down and we waited for people to turn up, and we waited and we waited and no one turned up. And so I finally said to the organiser, I might as well get on the bus and go home. So I did. I went on the bus and went home. So it was like a 15-hour journey all the way there to the meeting. You know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes at the venue, and then 15 hours going home. So thank you for turning up. It just massages a very frail and fragile ego. So thank you. You've done your good deed for the day. Let me begin with a confession that over the last decade, I've become increasingly depressed. And if the stats are right, I'm not the only one. Chances are that many of you in recent times have become increasingly depressed too. I see a few people nodding, not so much so that everybody nearby notices, but just so I can know. Yeah. In fact, this is the international inaugural meeting for depressed activists, people who feel like they're fighting on every front and losing most of the battles. If you're feeling a little like that, or if you felt a little like that over the last few years, this is the place to be. The stats are is that depression is now the number one psychological disorder in the Western world, and if trends continue, it'll be the second most disabling condition throughout the whole world, behind heart disease. And if you look at a country like your own, the stats suggest that at any one time up to 20% of the people experience some degree of depression. And they think that at least 10 times more people are depressed than they were 50 years ago. Now in Australia, we're really onto this. Depression's endemic in Australia too. And it's not just because of the fact that we lost the Ashes last time around. By the way, we're having another go soon, so let's see. We've got an umpire in training by the name of Daryl Hare that we're hoping to... Yes, somebody decisive that can intervene when our position's threatened. I think we've got a chance. But in Australia, we're really smart about depression. In Australia, lots of people use alcohol to treat depression. However, those of you that have drunk a lot know that actually alcohol is a depressant. So even though we do our best to treat our depression and self-medicate with a lot of alcohol, a lot of us have just found ourselves getting increasingly depressed. And the tragic consequence of that is in my country, over 40,000 Australians every year between the age of 15 and 24 try to commit suicide. Now, I'm not going to actually ask you to put your hands up and kind of disclose whether you've felt depressed lately yourself, but I'm going to risk a little and tell you a bit of my story. Because I'm absolutely convinced what is most personal is most universal. You know, that what I'm struggling with as a human being in today's world are issues that you're struggling with too. My wife and I have a tradition that we start every day with a cup of tea. We have a cup of tea together and we sit there and we have a chat and we talk about the day. And I can remember recently I was sitting down and we were sipping our cups of tea and I was very quiet and a little withdrawn. I don't think I was pathological, but just maybe a tiny bit depressed. And my dear wife Ange was looking at me and kind of waited and then said, sweetie, that's what she calls me, sweetie. And she said, yeah, it's kind of cute, isn't it? Some time ago, I rated myself on the fruit of the Spirit, you know, 1 to 10 on all the qualities of the fruit of the Spirit. And I didn't do very well, but I would have done a lot worse if Ange had rated me. But I did better on the tough qualities, but I didn't do so well on the tender ones, you know, like kindness. And so I did a bit of research around kindness, and I saw that in the text, in the original, it's saying sweetness. And not bitterness, not sourness, but sweetness. I thought, oh, that's what I should cultivate more. And then as I sat with that reflection, I thought, oh my God, I've been married for 35 years and my wife has been calling forth this quality, trying to evoke a little more sweetness, and I've missed the point for 35 years. Some of us are slow learners. Anyway, my wife has learned to be a little bit more direct over time, and this morning she was she'd decided it was time to kind of take me up on something, and she said to me, sweetie, can I ask you a question? And I said, yeah, what's that? She said, look, I just want to check. Was it your sister that died last year? Or was it you? Because she said, it's actually like living with a corpse. Anybody that knows my wife knows that she can be direct when she needs to be. I tell people that my wife helps me to be better than I'd like to be. She says, I really think you need to sort yourself out. I think you're becoming really depressed and you're of no use to me or anybody else. And I decided it was time to visit a psychiatrist. And fortunately, I knew a psychiatrist that I could visit because I'd been to a psychiatrist before. I'd been twice. Once when I was a boy and I'd been sexually abused by my church youth leader. Yes, there is a correlation between sexual abuse and depression. And the second time I'd gone was when Interserve had sent me to a psychiatrist to get an assessment before going as a missionary to India, because I think they probably think there's a correlation between anybody who wants to sell everything they have, give it to the poor, and insanity. So anybody that wants to do that kind of thing, they send to a psychiatrist, you know. So I knew this really nice, wise old psychiatrist that had kind of been really, really helpful to me when I went to him as a kid, and who'd been kind enough to pass my assessment when I went to India. And so I went to him and I said to this guy Dr. Webster, look, I'm feeling a bit depressed, and I want to know whether you think it's biochemical or it's existential, right? That's the thing I was struggling with, you know. And he said, okay, well, tell me, what do you feel depressed about? Well, I said, really, I'm depressed about the state of the world. It's okay saying that we should become increasingly sensitive people, that the gospel's all about love and being vulnerable and being compassionate. But the reality is I live in a world where there's tremendous pain. And my experience is that as I identify with that pain, I experience that pain. And I feel that as I experience that pain and the terrible injustice that it represents, I just become increasingly angry. And either I take it out on other people, which isn't really good when you're meant to be a Christian, I internalise it and take it out on myself. And internalised anger leads to depression. So he said, what are some of the things you're angry about? Well, I said, look, I'm just really angry about the poverty that there is in the world. You know, just a rich world. with so many poor people. You know, there are over 1.5 billion hungry people in the world. And if they were to line up here at Greenbelt to try and get some food and drink, the line would go across the fields and across the ocean and around the world, not 5 times, not 10 times, but 25 times. And if we were going to pop in a car and drive, what's the speed limit here? 30? Is it? 30 mile an hour. We're a driver at 30 mile an hour down that line, just distributing food all the way. It would take us 2.5 years to get to the line of hungry people in the world. And on more than one occasion, I've gone to the end of the line to find out what life is like for people. I can remember going to Sudan some time ago and just being confronted with people right at the end of the line. Lepers whose livelihood had been destroyed by armies fighting back and forth across their land, destroying their crops, leaving them bereft of all their property, so they didn't even have any clothes. Just totally and utterly destitute. And when I remember those people and remember their complete and total abandonment, I am overwhelmed by it. And then I look at the violence in the world. The coalition of the killing that your country and mine have supported, in which over 100,000 innocent Iraqis have been killed. Names like Hafitha and Fallujah and Samara and Mahdi come to mind. We think of all the victims who've been killed and all those who have been injured. And we see the news and our heart breaks as we're confronted with this terrible pain in the human family, this relentless, remorseless iniquity that is destroying and damaging people's lives. And as I began to unpack my despair to the psychiatrist, I looked at him and said, "Well, what do you think?" And he said, "Well, to tell you the truth, Dave, I think you're clinically depressed, but you have every right to be." Huh? Paul says we need to mourn with those that mourn. If we can look at the pain in the world at the moment without being caught up with an empathy that profoundly affects us, then we're sick. It's healthy to feel great sorrow in a world in distress. But then Dr. Webster said, however, I'd like to suggest that your wife does have a point. You may have every right to be depressed, but it's not particularly helpful to you or anybody else. And I said, yes, my wife told me that. She said I was useless. She said I was of no use to her or anybody else. And he said, yes, that's probably right. And then I thought of a man by the name of Dr. Dinabandhu. When I was working in India, I was once asked to go to talk to a man by the name of Dr. Dinabandhu, because he was really depressed and I was asked to go and help him. Anyway, Dr. Dinabandhu had been a young Gandhian and been a part of the independence struggle in India, and caught up with the euphoria of the possibility of profound political and social and cultural change in his country. And he'd met Mahatma Gandhi and Dr. Dinabandhu, who is training as a doctor, said to Gandhi, "Look, I'm really excited about this movement. You know, we may be able to make a difference in our country, and I'd like to be a part of that. And I was just wondering whether you've got any advice for me." And Gandhi said to Dinabandhu, "Well, don't go to the cities and just get a rich medical practice. Go to the villages and use your expertise to serve the poor." And Dr. Dinabandhu had taken that on board, and it became his vocation. And for the next 40 to 50 years, he had spent his life in the village working with the poor. And to begin with, he'd actually started giving free medical services to all the poor that came. And then he'd charge a few rich people to defray some of the expenses. But as time went by and the world became more corporate and less caring, he had to charge more and more people to pay for the people that came, until in the end he was charging the majority of the people that came and just was unable to provide free health care to the masses of people that came. And as he saw the lines lined up outside of his hospital of people that he could not care for, he became increasingly depressed. And one day, he just became catatonic. He just sat in his chair and stared at a wall and just couldn't get up. Now, I don't know whether you've ever felt like that, but I felt like that. Where you feel like it's too much. It's too overwhelming. How is it possible to respond? And I remember at the time trying to get through to Dr. Dinabandhu, trying to speak to him. But I only ever heard him say one thing. And I'll never forget his words. I actually tried to find a way of connecting with him. And I thought maybe the best way I could get through to him was to evoke his memory of Gandhiji. And so I sat with him for a while. And he sat in the stillness staring at the wall. And eventually I said to him, "Dr. G, what do you think Mahatma Gandhi would think of things now?" And his eyes flickered for the first time. There was a connection happening there. And then he turned to me and he said, "Where is Gandhi now? He's just a statue in the cities that the birds shit on." And you had the sense of this beautiful man as committed as the day is long, who's poured out his life for the poor, who loved Gandhi but now saw Gandhi as an ideal that he could never realise, a vocation that called him to a task that he could never do. And he was faced with the terrible contradictions. And he collapsed into despair, and I never heard him speak again. And I realised that as I was talking with Dr. Webster, that I had to face this issue like Dr. Dinabandhu had. And so I asked him, I said, "What do you think I should do?" And he said, "Dave, you need to learn to live like the Apostle Paul." Because Paul learned how to be depressed without being dysfunctional. I said, "Really?" He said, Paul says that he was often beaten, but while there was still breath in his body, he was not finished. For Paul, it didn't matter how much they took away from him. The challenge was what he did with what he had left. And he was beaten many times. He was stoned many times. And he said death was at work in him, but he was determined that life might be at work in others. Remember those texts? You just pick up this resolute soul who is determined not to be crippled by their despair, but to practice hope in the midst of hopelessness. So he said to me, Dave, you need to be a bit more like Paul. And he looked at his watch and he said, oh, time's up. So I left with that challenge. It's like Dr. Dinabundu trying to be like Mahatma Gandhi. You know, Dave Andrews trying to be like St. Paul. See, even the universe is crying. See? And so I went on my way to think how I could do that. There's still room in here if you'd like to come in. And he was kind enough to give me a few antidepressants to help me on my way. So I went back to reflect on this. And how could I allow myself to be beaten up, but to be resolute not to lay down and die? And as I reflected on it, I became convinced more and more that the secret was joy. Anger cannot sustain us. Duty cannot sustain us. Obligations cannot sustain us. The only thing that can sustain us is joy. Joy gives us energy. Joy gives us strength. And as I thought about it, I thought, oh my God, I remember a song like that. Does anybody remember that song? The joy of the Lord is my strength. And I would just kind of thought, oh no. You know, because for me it's like a demented Kylie Minogue playing a terrible kind of pop gospel song on high rotation on the Dave Andrews hit list. You know, it's just again and again, the joy of the Lord is my strength, the joy of my Lord. Oh, okay. I was thinking, oh no, I can't cope with that. I mean, I'd prefer to be a depressed than be a happy clappy. You know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? Oh, yes. Other people feel the same. Ah, oh, I just couldn't cope with it, you know what I mean? And I was kind of reacting against that little ditty going through my brain. And I thought, no, don't be so reactive. Let's be a little mature here. And I thought, I wonder where that text comes from. Does anybody know where that text comes from? The joy of the Lord is my strength. Anybody here?
Nehemiah.
That's right. Nehemiah. The text actually comes from a context where people are looking at the destruction of a civilization. Right? And rebuilding in the midst of the destruction, brick by brick, putting things back together again. And they're saying to each other, it's the joy of the Lord that is our strength. This is what will sustain us in this struggle. There's no pretense about the catastrophe. The catastrophe is there. The sorrow is there. But in the midst of the sorrow, there's a discovery of joy that energizes people in the struggle. I'm not ranting. I'm just speaking a little more loudly. Just have to keep that. Otherwise, he'll walk on here and drag me off. So I thought, yes, that's it. It's to feel the sorrow, but in the midst of the sorrow, to find joy that can sustain me in the struggle. That's what I've got to do. But how the hell do you do that? Huh? How the hell do you do that? So I thought, okay, I'm going to follow the advice of this psychiatrist and check out Paul. And I went to that passage in Philippians where he says, rejoice or rediscover your joy. And I thought, maybe that's where I can start. And I looked a few verses down and I found some phrases that all of you know that have become the secret for me of finding joy in the midst of the sorrow. And these verses go like this. Whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if there is any excellence in these things, think about these things. This is cognitive therapy before it was invented. Huh? I mean, what happens if we look at the world around about us and focus on the things that are going wrong? We're going to feel depressed, aren't we? The only hope for us is to be aware of everything, the good and the bad, but to focus on the good. Because the good is inherently joyful, inherently energizing, inherently encouraging. Do you understand what I'm saying? Huh? I'm not saying we should pretend things are better than they are. We need to face reality squarely and feel the pain of that. But the challenge for me and for all of us, I believe, is to be aware of all that is happening, both the good and the bad, but to focus on whatever is good, whatever is right, whatever is holy, whatever is helpful, to focus on those things, to think about those things. Paul goes on to say in Romans, not that everything is working out for good, but in everything God is working for good. The secret to practicing joy in the midst of the sorrow is to look for where God is at work. To see whatever is good. To recognize that. To celebrate that. To look for simple and practical ways to collaborate with that. To cooperate with that. And in the midst of the sorrow, to be caught up with the joy of participating in God's global conspiracy of the Spirit to subvert the dominant paradigms of our society that are bringing so much suffering in the world. I rejoice in the Millennium Development Goals. Sure, they're minimal development goals, not maximal development goals, but I rejoice that for the first time in history, all nations on earth have signed up to halve world poverty by 2015. I rejoice in the Make Poverty History campaign. With all its faults, we find a movement of people who want to engage in justice in the world. I rejoice in the MICA network, a movement of 300 Christian aid and development agencies around the world who are seeking for creative ways to unleash the energy of the church, the knowledge and resources of the church in the service of the poor. I rejoice in quiet lifestyle revolutions like downshifting. Up to 20% of the people in this country are choosing to opt out of the rat race and downshift, to live more simply, to share their resources, to invest more energy in causes for justice. Now, in your country, a lot of those people are yuppies. But in my country, it's across the classes. People from the top to the bottom, up to 25% of the population, are voluntarily opting out of the rat race, trying to discover their humanity again. I rejoice in homegrown advocacy movements. In my own country, we've got a net-based campaign called Get Up. And recently, our beloved Howard government was trying to introduce yet another draconian form of legislation to keep refugees out of our country. We've actually excised the top portion of the Australian continent so that anybody that lands on that shores cannot access Australian law or due process. I think they're going to continue excising until we get down just to Canberra. You know, so unless you get to Canberra, you can't actually access due process. Well, they were trying to now take that further by saying that anybody that came by boat to Australia would be immediately transferred onto a big ship. Not a prison ship. It's called a mothership. You know, very kind, very caring. But it just stops people from landing on the land just in case they get all the way to Canberra and can claim asylum. Anyway, so fortunately, through GetUp, over 100,000 Australians signed up to protest against this, and the legislation was scuttled. I rejoice in that. I rejoice in grassroots community groups like my own, the Waiters Union, a small group of 30, 40 people who are committed to advocating rights of Indigenous people, who are committed to welcoming refugees to our country. Last year, we had a little revolving loan scheme to give people the money to buy airfares to come to our country when they got visas as refugees. And we, our little group of just 30 people brought 57 people over. Now, I think that's fantastic. I rejoice in that. I rejoice in the fact that we train people to live and work with the poor. That Donna went to as a human shield to Iraq during the war. That Jason is now doing non-violence training in West Papua. That Kerry went to do community development in Colombia. That Armin went to do leadership training in Armenia. That Bronwyn went to work with orphans in Bosnia. That Hannah went to work with orphans in Thailand. That Peter went to work with youth in South Africa. Our little group, 30 or 40 people, have had over 400 people come through our community. And a large number of those people have gone on to work with the poor in other urban contexts or rural contexts in Australia and overseas. Some of you will have been to the servants' stall here. I encourage you to go and check it out. Mark and Kathy from our community have gone with servants to go and live in a slum in Delhi alongside the poorest of the poor, to enter into their experience, to support them in their struggle. I rejoice in that. Let me conclude and then give you an opportunity to make comments or ask a question. Let me conclude by saying this. I don't think I'm the only person in this room that gets depressed. We may get depressed. We may have good reason to get depressed. But we needn't be dysfunctional. We needn't let it cripple us. The challenge of us, for all of us, is to practice hope in the midst of despair. To find joy in the midst of sorrow that can energise us and help us to engage in the struggle creatively and constructively. Yes, they may cut down all the trees, as Pablo Neruda said, but they cannot stop the coming of spring. And our challenge is to plant seeds of hope in the grounds of despair, one by one, to nurture those seeds of hope in the grounds of despair and see them bear fruit of love and joy and peace. For I believe that as we practice hope in the midst of despair, against all the odds, that God will honour us, God will encourage us, and God will vindicate us. Let it be. Now, is there any comments that anybody would like to make or any questions you'd like to ask? We've got a microphone here. If you don't have a question, I'd like to ask a question. So, there is a question. Yep. Jesus. Traditionally, the word amen has been used after somebody's made a statement. Jesus was the first person to use that word before he made a statement. Have you noticed that? And what it is, it's a sign of this resolute determination, regardless.
Use the mic, Dave.
Okay.
Use the mic.
Okay. See how compliant I am? Yeah. Comment. Question.
Try it.
Okay. I was just wondering how you managed to contact the people that you said you managed to bring into Australia.
What happens is that our government likes to look like it's being generous without being generous. All spin. So they give people visas to come, but they don't give them any money to come. You know, they're poor people, they have no money. So what we do is people who know those people who are already in Australia will contact us and say, we know we've got some friends or relatives who want to come. They don't have any money. Could we apply for a loan on their behalf. And so they contact us and we give them loans. So, you know, we have at any time between $70,000 and $100,000 out in revolving loans. When they come, they then pay those loans back. No fees, no interest. And then that money's made available to the next lot of people. And we've had no defaults.
I just wanted to say that I really identify with the anger. And like with my experience, I had the anger, and then I got trained in order in my job, like in order to be able to grapple with things. That's it really. It's
right.
Good to be trained.
Yeah. Well, I think I see. I'll be talking about this next session tomorrow. But I mean, a lot of us are brought up to believe that we shouldn't be angry, and that Jesus advocated no anger. But that's not true. Jesus got angry himself. The big challenge is to find creative ways of channeling our rage. And attacking other people or attacking ourselves are very unhelpful ways of doing that. Either aggression or depression are actually unhelpful. So we, but anger is helpful for an explosive spurt of involvement, but it's not a sustaining energy. And that's why we need to find something other than anger to sustain us. And I believe that's joy. And I think goodness is inherently joyful. Anytime we say something good or do something good, it's a trip. You know, it's exciting, it's ecstatic, and that's what sustains us, you know, the joy in goodness. So wherever we identify anything good that's happening and become a part of that, that's inherently joyful, that sustains us. So moments of anger are great, but a lifetime of anger ain't so great. Normally the anger is so strong it burns us out. Or breaks down our relationships.
Hello? Hello? Yeah, over here. I got something to say, please.
Oh, yes.
Now, today we are at Greenbelt, a festival, you see, a festival for Christians who love humanity. The black, the white, the rich, the poor, wherever you may go. Yes, the love of God, everyone has to know. The black, the white, as I've said before, wherever you go, yes, from shore to shore, from country to country, from continent, you see, everywhere you go, God's love will be. Always be with the people of the nations. Everyone must hear, and when they've got God in their heart, they have nothing to fear, because love from God above, so special, it's so true, provide you with the hope that is long overdue. In the pages of the Bible, you read it and you will see, and that is why you trust in God for all eternity. Thank you.
I'm just wondering, you talked about when you are rediscovering joy when sleeping. I don't know whether you use that as
Yes, I think, so how do you move from the intellectual to the emotions? So for example, I can say, as it says in Romans, that God is good and working in all things for good. But that's an intellectual construct. How does that actually change your emotional state of being when in fact you're depressed? For me, I think the intellectual construct gives a direction for you to move in. And for me, when I remember that God is good, and I enter into an experience of the goodness of God, and I experience the reality of God's love for me, I feel the joy. I feel glad to be alive. I feel that I can love as I am loved. And that then energizes me to engage much more creatively and constructively. I think a strong emotion beats a good idea any day of the week. And we need to move beyond just the intellectual constructs to the emotional experience of the things that we're talking about. So thank you very much.
Hi, Dave.
Just got a few moments. Yep.
I've got two, but you may only want to answer one of them. They're slightly different. The first is picking up on the previous one and just asking about the link with kind of contemplation and all that sort of side of spirituality. And the second one was just to say, in your list of things that made you angry, you didn't really cover environmental ones and climate change, and just to raise that question.
Yes, I'm sorry I didn't give a complete list. Yeah, the reality is, it's a long list, isn't it? And I just thought I'd pick on two just to illustrate my point. But I think that that's an important point to make. I think if the next generation condemns my generation, it'll be over ecological issues. And so I think it's important to make that statement and for that to be heard. But yes, I am really angry about my government, which along with the US, yet again, is the only country that hasn't signed the Kyoto Protocol. These days, when I go abroad, in fact, I feel that when I introduce myself, I need to go through a little routine that goes something like this. Hi, my name's Dave Andrews. I'm from Australia, and I'm sorry. You know, so, we're complicit in policies that are destroying the planet, and my country's a part of that. And that causes me great concern too. But I'd like just to get back again to the focusing on some of the good things. Sorry, I don't get too depressed and finish crying. Yeah, so, but yeah, the point's legitimate. Now, in terms of contemplation, yes, contemplation is actually a very important discipline for me. And I tell people, if I don't contemplate, then I feel like killing myself. So it's contemplation that puts me in touch existentially with the love of God that makes me feel loved myself, that so can sustain me and then enable me to love others as I love myself, and then creates a creative dynamic that comes into a very damaging and destructive cycle. So contemplation is at the heart of that response. Probably time for one more comment, and then I'd just like to wrap up by saying something. Sorry.
Hello. I just wondered how, if you're trying to be there for someone else, how do you begin to try to connect with them in the midst of that anger, that depressive anger, where everything you say or suggest is considered to be manipulative or trying to interfere, and it's just automatically dismissed? Because they're so angry that how do you help someone else through that? If it's not you, how can you do? Yeah.
So the question is, how do you help other people work through engaging other people when they're so angry and they're freighting everything with this rage and it's really not helping the conversation? Yeah. Well, when those people are actually directing that rage at me, and I try to help them with that, the way I try to do that is give them space to express the rage, to ventilate, to begin with. And then, as they get exhausted, I then try to respond to them in a way that makes them feel that I've actually heard what they're saying to me. And once people get beyond ventilating and feel that you're actually listening to what they say, then more often than not, my experience has been you can move on to another stage where, in fact, you can begin to have a dialogue around that stuff. But there's no easy way. I mean, we've got to create space for ventilation, and we've got to move beyond just hearing what people say to really deeply listening to one another so that we can move on to dialogue. That's as much as I can say at the moment. Look, I'd like to thank you for coming and for participating in this public reflection. And I want to say that I pray for you as I pray for myself, that in the midst of this sorrow we might find joy, that all of us might find a way to experience joy, and that joy will energise us so that we don't just grit our teeth, you know. We don't just kind of clench our fists, but we find this inner joie de vivre, this joy of being alive that enables to fight the forces of darkness and that does it with style and with excitement and enthusiasm and constantly finds a source, that source that we can go back to again and again and again to renew us in our resolve. For those of you that would be interested in taking these things a stage further, for the next 3 days, this afternoon, tomorrow afternoon and the next afternoon, I'm actually running a workshop for 2 hours for a smaller group of people looking at compassionate community work. How do we turn these things that we're concerned about into creative and constructive responses? How do we work with marginalised and disadvantaged people in our own localities? How do we just not just complain about the bad news, how do we become the good news? And if you'd like to join us, check it out in the program. It's about 3:15 or 3:30 this afternoon and the next couple of days. It would really be great if you could be a part of that.